News on Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook coming up in this hour. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
And you are tuned in to WBAI New York. It's 7 o'clock time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself off shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse, but if they could, they would. Only bomb for the best, just take the worst. I hope that's understood, but did it know?
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined tonight by Kyle.
Hi, coming in loud and clear over here.
Yeah, a bit flustered, a lot going on. Let's open up the Skype lines here. And joining us is Alex.
Hello from the snowy Pocono Mountains.
You went out to Pennsylvania in this weather.
I went out very early this morning.
Wow, okay. And Rob is joining us as well.
Good evening from snowy Queens, New York.
And Gila, who's sitting right next to him.
I am. It's still snowy Queens, New York.
And it's snowy out here on Long Island, where we expect to lose power any moment, and that's going to be a lot of fun. It's a blizzard. It's snowing outside. It's snowing in December. I'm happy, and it's another reason to stay indoors. If we need more reasons to stay inside, here's another one. We have an hour of technological talk from the world of hackers. And at 8 o'clock, we'll be doing overtime again on our YouTube channel, Channel 2600. And you can call us and speak to us as callers did last week, which is neat. We heard from people all over the place. So, everybody safe and dry? Alex, I'm especially worried about you being out there in the tundra.
Yeah, it's freezing here. It's about 15 degrees. It is, it's been snowing since about 1 p.m. It's really incredible out there. I mean, it's whiteout conditions and, not the kind of stuff that you want to go out and drive in, I would think. So hopefully by tomorrow, when I'm due to head back to New York in the afternoon or the evening.
You think you're going back to New York in the afternoon? I'm sorry. That's funny. No, you're going to be there for a while, I think. It's going to be 18 inches, they're saying. It's not going to stop till tomorrow afternoon.
No, I've got a Volkswagen, and I can just drive right through it.
Oh, you got a Volkswagen. Okay, never mind then. You can get through anything. All right. Rob, you're safe there in Queens, right?
We are safe. We were out of the apartment earlier this afternoon, and it was amazing. We had a thing to go to when we went. It was completely dry, and while we were there, the snow started, and we walked out into an absolute snow globe. It was amazing.
Uh-huh. This is what winter should be, you know, and don't listen to people who complain about it. Diversity, that's the spice of life, and having four seasons in a year is a good thing, and here in New York we savor that. So I'm glad we're getting some cold weather. I'm glad we're getting some snow. climate change is still a thing, so don't listen to Trump if he shows you a snowball or something and says, yeah, everything is fixed. No, that's not how it works. But please be safe. Be safe on the COVID front. Be safe on the blizzard front. And listen to the radio. Nothing better than listening to the radio. Well, actually, there is something better than listening to the radio, and that's listening to old voice BBS recordings from 25 years ago. We went through a couple more, not very many this week, because we've been extremely busy. But I just wanted to play a couple that I think they come from 1996, if I'm going to guess. Let's listen to a couple of rescued voice files, thanks to a couple of our listeners. Who really helped us figure out how to convert the files and get the playback just right. Let's listen to the voice of a hacker from many years ago who might actually hear his voice today and be shocked.
Yes, this is William Till, and I wanted to leave something for our hacker friends in the United Kingdom, which I discovered when calling World Premier Customer Service. WorldLink, World Premier, however you want to call them, they've just started up a new World Premier card for the United Kingdom. The name of it is British Airways Card. And from the United Kingdom, to activate a British Airways prepaid card, you would call 0800-279-2700. Once again, that's 0800-279-2700. Works just like the world premieres in the United States, but it's primarily for use in the United Kingdom. And I know that sometimes our British friends do call here, so that's one for you guys.
Isn't that nice? Helping out the hackers from all around the planet. Alex, you remember that service at all?
I think I do, actually. Yeah. I think I do, and it was very kind of him to to share that knowledge, I have to say.
Yeah, Rob, you looked like you had a note of recognition in your eyes.
It just sounded very familiar, and it's also kind of just generally emblematic of the messages I loved so much on that thing back in its day.
A lot of the messages, just,
People being helpful.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of helpful messages, but there are a lot of messages also we can't play on the air because they don't have that same mood to them. They are funny.
I like those too, but
yeah, they're pretty interesting. Well, you have to figure out how to share these, the best way to do it, and we're getting all kinds of listener suggestions. So if you have suggestions on what we can do with, well, we have over 4,000 files. That doesn't mean we have anything near that number of messages, but we definitely have hundreds, if not thousands, of messages. Public messages, well, private ones we'll probably keep private since people had voice mailboxes. I don't think we should share those. But some of these public ones have information that, woefully outdated, is still interesting and speaks to the hacker mentality.
I think that's what's brilliant, and especially making some of the more aggressive ones a little bit funnier because they're out of context, uh-huh. Because it's so much later. And it's the same thing with technologies. You can still apply and find parallels and glean cool bits and history out.
Yeah, and somebody listening today can say, hey, that's my dad, a 13-year-old hacker who is calling in to share information on how to clone a cell phone. Okay, we have one more. This is from somebody more local, from someone from 718, so they could actually be listening right now.
Yes, this is the Jackal from MPA 718. Just calling because I need some info concerning Juno, the email free service. Anyway, I recently set up my account, and then I checked out the modem initiation files to determine the username and the password to get into the system. After doing that, I dialed up Juno through my modem directly and got into the system, entered the username, and tried to enter the password, but the system won't allow me to do it. So if anybody could advise me on how I can get the system to accept me entering the password, I'd appreciate that. What else? I know it's something simple, though. What else? Has anybody ever heard of 800 Cheap Talk? That's an LDS long-distance service that allows you to dial directly through without a credit card to call long distance. I'm thinking that they probably separately bill because my long distance service is blocked and it still allows me to make a phone call you know. So anybody can give me info on that, I appreciate that. Lastly, what I want to say. Oh, it seems to me that there's only a few people on this system that really has useful info. And one of them is Intercept. I just want to say thanks for calling this line, you know, because there are a lot of people out there that can use your info. You know, even if they're lame, at least, you know, they're trying to learn something. Why everybody else just wants to preach about who's lame and who's not. Peace.
Okay. Well, a little bit of a lecture there. Duly noted. I hope we've learned something in 25 years. Any tips on Juno, or what was the other one? Cheap Talk? No? Alex?
Yeah, that just brings back so many memories, and I think really is emblematic of the fact that this was really a scene. Right? What he was talking about at the end was you know, essentially people gossiping about each other about who's elite and who's lame and who's got good info and who doesn't, and he was interested in some sort of content, and I think that's pretty cool. I think that is, you know, it really brought back a lot of memories, because you know, there was even in the voicemail hacking and the hacker community, any kind of subculture, right? There's always going to be some form of hierarchy where people think that they're cool and others aren't. But, you know, for him, and I think for most hackers, it's always about the information, about sharing that information. And I think he captured that spirit really well. I think that was a great recording.
Rob, do you have something to add?
Yeah, Juno, for those who don't remember, it was basically a dial-up online service like your America Online, CompuServe, things that existed back then. But they would offer you free access in exchange for, usually they would put a big ad banner somewhere on your screen and make money through showing you the ads, which, you know, seems crazy now that somebody would give you free email in exchange for showing you ads, except that's how pretty much the entire internet ecosystem works now. But Those were really fun to play with, because they were very cyberpunk. They were a scrappy way to get access if you were, you know, a poor kid out there who couldn't keep making long distance calls or whatever.
Right.
And it was just a lot of fun to find ways around what they were trying to do in order to get direct access to their systems that they were offering without going through having to watch their ads.
So that was the thing, to get into Juno and not deal with ads. Mm-hmm. And then you have free email, something that we take for granted now, free phone call, something we also take for granted. But why do you think Juno didn't succeed? Because isn't that exactly what Gmail does now?
You would think. I think they just might have been a little ahead of the curve with how much people would require free access to email, and in fact expect that to be a thing. You know, the online world in general was people using things like America Online. You had to use their client to dial in. And this person was trying to just dial straight in without that client, just making a direct modem-to-modem connection with their own software. But yeah, it was there were ways to make that happen. Sometimes that was like this person was saying, finding the username and the password that the thing was secretly using to get into the system behind the scenes, as it were.
Well, the whole concept of dialing in, that's something that I think is alien to so many of our listeners now. Yes, go ahead, Alex.
Building on what Rob said, and I think he's precisely right here, that this was a very early stage revenue model based entirely on advertising. And I think the Junos of the world, if we remember correctly, probably started to go away entirely as Gmail started to rise exponentially. And Gmail was very interesting to a lot of people back in the day, because in addition to it being a free email service, ostensibly free, again, ad-sponsored, it was also, or rather should be considered, one of the first cloud storage service providers as well, because they were giving you about a gig of storage for your emails, for your attachments. So that made Gmail much more attractive than a service like Juno. And then Google became very adept at looking at your emails, scanning your emails, finding what the keywords were, and then monetizing that for their advertising base. And that's probably something that Juno did not do nearly as effectively, and so their revenue model was probably flawed from the outset, or at least, I think, inferior to Google's model.
I would echo those points and really just elaborate on the fact that the approach and the growth model for Google and a smaller entity like Juno, they emerged at different on different trajectories in the timeline, and you imagine what Juno might have been working with. What computers were they trying to get online? What were their costs? I mean, there's a lot of like business decisions, and then what is the marketplace like? And I think a lot of this unique ways to get on online was because there really it was a huge push to attract users and get subscribers to your service, whereas I think Google, a lot more of their trajectory was attracting engineers, attracting talent, and breaking down these services and then approaching each one as they grew from purely search and ads. That's a really long way of saying they're just totally different companies at totally different times, I think, or emerged at different rates.
Do you remember how they did things when they rolled out Gmail? They made it something that people couldn't get. You had to have an invitation to have a Gmail account, and everybody wanted an invitation. And only because they did that. To me, Gmail, the whole concept was offensive from the start to today, where they scan your mail and show you ads based on what you say. I can't wrap my head around that. And even to this day, I use Gmail not as a primary communication, just as a convenience. But I'm getting warnings today that my Gmail account is getting full. A Gmail account I don't even use. It's completely filled up with their own spam. Most of it is from Gmail, and it's just they expect me to go through and clear it out. And no, I'm not going to do that. The other thing that happened only last week when I was forwarding something to a Gmail box, I was told that that Gmail account did not exist. And it existed because I cut and pasted and mailed again, and it went through. But they lose mail, and that is something that I never actually saw right in front of me happen like that, where it said clearly this account does not exist, have the evidence still. And then I just cut and pasted and did it again, and it worked. So that kind of thing is disturbing to me. And plus, just storing things in the cloud, not having physical access yourself in case something disappears, like Yahoo news groups, they're gone. As of yesterday, they disappeared. You cannot post in a Yahoo group anymore. And I know people at Pacifica and BAI are tearing their hair out because there's probably 100 different Yahoo groups.
That reminds me. I have to get in touch with the group. Thank you for
that. Oh, yeah, I don't think you can anymore.
Well, yeah, no, I'm going to have to look into whatever back channel
they can change up. The rules. And you know, Google introduces these, I remember Google Wave, all kinds of they should write a book about all the failed Google projects. They just decide to discontinue them, and you're out of luck.
There's really enormous lists of failed .com startups.
Uh-huh.
It's hilarious.
It's bad enough when operating systems change and you can't run your programs as easily as you used to be able to run them. I was just bemoaning this yesterday because I've a database in DBase 2, if you can believe that. From the old MS-DOS days. It's my video collection, okay? That's how I stored it. And finding something today that can read those files and allow you to actually interact with them, it can be done, but it's like the voice BBS all over again. And you're basically paying for somebody else changing their mind on how something should work. Works fine on a particular machine in a particular environment. You should be able to keep that. And fortunately, places like archive.org exist where you can go back to the past and see things as they were and even get things to work. So it's good that we communicate this and share this information. Rob, go ahead.
The other thing about like Juno and their like, there was Net Zero, there was Blue Light, which was owned by Kmart, I think. There was a whole bunch of them, but all of those had one single problem in front of them. They had to provide email service and make the ads profitable enough to cover the cost of that. Whereas Google, their main advantage has always been like how big they are and the fact that the email and Google Wave and whatever other little services they mm-hmm. give to you, that's not how Google makes their money. Google makes their money by bringing you in with these services and then getting your eyeballs on ads and also getting your biometric info, your ad watching and clicking info to develop a profile on you, which itself is a very profitable thing to have. But they don't have to make the email pay for itself. They don't have to make anything they do for you pay for itself, because with your eyeballs, you're paying for all of it. There's the old saying now that if you're not paying money for a service, you're not the customer. You're the product being sold.
Absolutely.
To the customer.
Absolutely. And if I continue my Google rant just a little bit more, they have completely destroyed YouTube. They really have. They have injected what they call mid-roll ads. You know what those are? You're watching a video. In the middle of the damn video, you get an ad, not just at the beginning and at the end, but right in the, sometimes in the most important part. And that was turned on by default. Everybody who puts up YouTube videos has to physically press buttons and opt out of that. Otherwise, the default is that there's an ad smack in the middle of your video. It's ridiculous. You know, there was one incredible example of how horrible this is. They have these really, really long videos some people put up of that's designed to let you go to sleep. It's rain on a roof, or the sound of the forest, or trains going by, all kinds of things. And they're 8 hours long, 10 hours long, 20 hours long. And you're drifting off to sleep. You know, you have this nice sound of crickets and maybe an owl or two, and the wind in the trees, maybe some rain. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of it, you get this loud advertisement because Google decided to put an ad in the middle of that video. And the person who put the video up didn't ask for that. They just inserted it. So that's when you don't control it. When you don't control it yourself, things like that happen. And you find yourself surprised. Alex.
Yeah, I've had that exact same experience with these annoying advertisements for YouTube videos, because oftentimes I'll drift off to sleep while I'm listening to some video about cosmology or astronomy. For some reason, thinking about black holes and event horizons and things expands my mind and puts me right out. It basically makes me into a narcolept or something. And then I'll wake up in the middle of a 30-minute advertisement. And you know, the headphone will still be in my ear or something, and I'll be very confused about what the hell I'm listening to. But then the other effect of that too is, which is, if you, let's say you did fall asleep, like I often do, within, you know, 2 or 3 minutes of putting on one of these cosmological conundrum videos, you were then listening to some advertisement for 30 minutes, mm-hmm. while you're sleeping. And who knows what the hell the effect of that is on you? I mean, you wake up, it may really make you have some very strange dreams, or otherwise, you know, subliminally affect you or retarget your tastes while you're sleeping. It's a strange thing to me.
Well, is it possible that your video just went to another video? Is it an ad inside that video, or did it go to a second video?
No, it's an ad inside the video.
And a 30-minute ad inside a video.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's
wow.
Incredible.
That is incredible. Okay, well, I think we've gotten all our anger. Yes, Gila.
Okay, now I have a question.
Go ahead.
Which is, I do wonder if the Google algorithms inside YouTube are related to the ads that you get served. I can only imagine. I did get one in Spanish yesterday. I got a Google Maps ad in YouTube in Spanish. I don't know why. But, yeah, I was listening to some stuff in the background, and all of a sudden Spanish, and I was thrown. But I'm curious if everybody's getting served the same ads in the YouTube, or if they're different for different users. I'm assuming they are, but I can't say one way or the other. But I'm still a little confused about the Spanish ad.
Google News. Now I'm sorry, but I keep thinking of more products, and they anger me. Google News. All right, that it used to be useful. It used to be a good aggregator where you could read stories from different places. But now every time you click on a story, it's a paywall. Why list stories that are paywalled? Am I supposed to subscribe to every newspaper in existence on the internet in order to use Google News? It's useless. It should be free stories that are put on the internet for you to read and nothing more. Otherwise, what's the point? All right. Yes, Rob, go ahead.
The unintended side effect of Google News and how they do things is sometimes, I'm not saying this works in all cases, but sometimes if you can manage to make the user agent string of your browser look like the one from Google News's bot, then sometimes the sites will show you the article thinking you're Google's bot, spidering their site.
So Google doesn't have to pay to read the article, but they show it to you and tell you to pay. That doesn't make any sense to me. The internet used to be so much cooler. I hope we can bring it back somehow. All right, we have some interesting stories that are going on. This really leapt out at me. An American hacker is claiming to have gained access to both the Canadian and the American emergency alert systems. That always piques my interest. According to a new report from Input, and I have no idea what Input is, I'm sorry, the hacker who goes by the alias Vertrux says he's able to send a message nationwide using a system he found open on the internet. By scanning for ports utilized by two systems commonly used in emergency alerts, Vertrux says he found millions of IP addresses. He then scanned through them for a list of keywords likely to be used in such alert systems and narrowed that down to thousands. I social engineered some manufacturers of these to give me either the service password or the default password, and after trying a few IPs I was in, I was disgusted. This is federal infrastructure. This isn't a printer left open. Vertrux claims that the system access points are available online for use by authorized users, but are also easily accessible by those with the technological knowledge. You can get whatever you need to gain full access, not to all, as most are updated, but a scary majority. This reminds me of the banking systems. They run COBOL because they are too lazy and cheap to upgrade to something more secure, and we get left with very old people who know how to program COBOL working on the banking and insurance infrastructure. Okay, I think a bit harsh there. I think the federal government needs to set up proper training for setup and usage of these devices and make it illegal to operate if you have not been trained. I'm not exactly sure what he means by that. Input refers to him as the hacktivist. The hacktivist says he could send whatever he pleases to millions of people. Theoretically, I can send anything from a volcano warning to the entire U.S. to an Amber Alert. If I really wanted, I could send out custom messages, too. He believes he can do the same in Canada. I'm sure the same is possible. Custom messages to countrywide levels of emergency. In the wrong hands, this can and will only incite panic, he says. I wouldn't go as far as to say the wrong message sent out can theoretically start a war, but I don't think it's all that impossible. And I'll tell you, Vertrux, it's not impossible because we live in a world where things are decreed by Twitter. And a war can be started not only through the emergency alert system, but through a tweet. And that is the problem. Well, the problem is obviously the fact that so many of these systems aren't kept secure in the first place, but the fact that we take things, we believe whatever we see flash across us on a device, whether it's reading Facebook, whether it's reading an SMS or a tweet, or even seeing something that comes across the EAS system. We need to do better as far as how we verify the information that we are given, because many times we're being lied to, or we're seeing something that purports to be something that it's not. You know, whether it's a forged email, some kind of phishing expedition. There are so many ways you can be fooled. All you have to do is believe what is in front of you, as far as text or even audio or video. So healthy skepticism, I think, is a good thing. I don't know. I'm healthily skeptic about this particular story. I'm not sure how true it is, but it's certainly, I think, possible theoretically.
Should there be fines maybe for default passwords?
Fines for default passwords? Well, that means somebody has to check your password. How do they do that?
Well, I mean, in the public interest, maybe not on a personal router, that's something you really need in your life.
How about this?
Default all you want.
When I was caught back in the 80s, all right, I was on a system called Telenet, actually a subset of that system called Telemail. And the reason I was able to get hundreds of accounts was because they used the default password of the letter A. And it was relatively easy for me to scroll down a list of accounts that were publicly available and simply try the letter A for each one and see how many I could get into. Now, something like that, when it's revealed that, this person hacked your system and was able to aim nukes and do all kinds of turn off electrical grids and things like that because you used the password A. Yeah, I think there should be a fine for that. That's stupid.
Well, especially
that's extreme, but it has to be revealed that they did something incredibly boneheaded like that.
Well, also with a huge push towards new EAS, I know just with some of the radio stations and broadcasters in general, there's been changes and updates to the systems. So if you're putting in all this new equipment, imagine that every broadcaster, everyone that is required, and they get pretty serious about the requirement for EAS. So why isn't there a requirement on this install instead of requiring the install and basically providing this enormous opportunity if defaults are widely kept?
Yes, go ahead, Alex.
I think 2 points, bouncing off both what you and Kyle had said. And number one, I think I would go even further, Emmanuel, with respect to the severity of this information coming from something like an emergency alert system. Remember, I guess it feels like a different world ago, but it was probably about 2 years ago, maybe, when we did the tests and had the party for the presidential alert system.
Yes.
And that was very cool.
I still have our flyer from that.
Yeah, that was fun. We had something in the commons downstairs, and
yeah, that's right. That's when we did radio in a studio. Remember that?
And saw people in person. Wow, good old days.
It was a different world. But in any event, the point I want to make here is that unlike Twitter, where people are used to seeing garbage, right? It's garbage in, garbage out, is the old platitude. People are used to being skeptical about stories on Twitter, and you know, even seeing the president of the United States' tweets himself being flagged as potentially false or misleading. So I think we're getting more used to that. But when you see something flash across your phone, whether it's an Amber Alert or something that looks like an official communication, you tend to believe it. So if this story is in fact true, I see it as extraordinarily dangerous. It's something that could be used by a foreign actor to create massive havoc. I mean, think about the weather alerts that could be going on, you know, right now, or something that would have related to protests.
Can I just butt in for a second, Alex? There's always this mention of foreign actors. Why is it the foreign actors we're most concerned about? How about the domestic actors? Because there's a whole lot of them causing all kinds of mayhem right now with false information, misleading people. I don't think we have to get nationalistic about this. I think this is just something where we need to be more educated as far as what is true and what is not true, what is unlikely to be true, how to question, how to check, how to verify, how to access multiple sources of information and not just believe whatever you're told, whether it's coming from us or your uncle on Facebook or Newsmax or whatever.
I agree with that. It doesn't have to be a foreign actor. It can be domestic. Just, you know, a general threat actor could utilize this for extraordinarily malicious purposes, especially when we're in the middle of a global health crisis, for God's sakes, right? I mean, think about the misinformation that can come across your phone.
That's your opinion, Alex, that it's a global health crisis. Right. Are these things real? We don't know.
But going back to what Kyle had said, too, he raises an interesting point, which is essentially about fines for having horrible security configurations. And if you're a regulated entity, let's say you're regulated by the FTC or Health and Human Services, and you're not HIPAA compliant, something like that, it is certainly possible to be fined by a regulatory body for having insufficient security practices in place. And certain regulated entities are required to undergo enterprise risk assessments to look for things like these, you know, idiotic default passwords that are placed up there. But to Kyle's point, though, what's very interesting about this is if the entity that is housing the insecure system is in fact the government, then how would you fine them? It would be our tax dollars. They would pay a fine with our tax dollars. That doesn't seem fair, right? I mean, at that point, you know, we need to have, I think, better ways of regulating the regulators' systems, better ways of regulating governmental systems and ensuring that, and also having a carrot and stick approach there too, some kind of penalty when it comes to government, state, local, or federal, not securing their systems properly.
I would just feel like this is like a personnel, like accountability. This would be like an HR escalation. I mean, if I change the oil in your car and I don't torque your drain plug or whatever, and you need a new motor, like, you're going to come back at me over it and my competency as a technician. So if a technician's installing something either as a contractor or working directly for the government, and their choice is to not go the next step, but I don't know if that's necessarily the first culprit, right? I think there's a lot of people operating these systems that may not be a governmental entity, but if that's our focus, yeah, I feel like that would come back on whomever the technician was. Maybe that's not a huge fine levied
at all. Maybe it's more your certification or whatever alleged qualification got you to that point probably would be in question, after so long. I'm not, but the contractor or whomever would probably have, there would be some kind of repercussion, maybe not a fine per se, but you raise a good point. That's a good point because how circular do you want to get with public, and bureaucratic policing?
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that we're going to have trouble figuring out who is policing whom and who has more authority and more knowledge and things like that. But the one thing we can do to help the situation is always have that healthy skepticism. Now, healthy skepticism versus unhealthy skepticism. How do we differentiate? Because if you have a bunch of people refusing to take a vaccine, for instance, because they don't believe they're being told the truth, how do you counter that? I think the way is to have as many trusted news sources out there that people can go to ask questions and to get information, and not just simply treat every blog out there as if it's equivalent to the New York Times, because it's not. There are people that you can basically rely upon to give you accurate information, and there are people who are complete phonies. We need to be able to judge for ourselves who knows what they're talking about and who does not. And unfortunately, we're in a society right now where basically a lot of the skilled people are being torn down by very powerful people. And that has a price. That has a very high price because people stop trusting the very people they should be trusting and start listening to people who don't know what they're talking about. Then you have an uneducated, suspicious populace, and it becomes really, really hard to get any bit of information out and to not be completely led around by the nose.
I think it's really hard to pick and choose which emergencies, though. I mean, with EAS, it's a different sort of thing than like, I think what I'm hearing as a wider social misunderstanding. In other words, people talking past one another. Mm-hmm. Or another concern I'm hearing that I would imagine in this is confirmation bias. Like, if somebody's rioting and you're looking for that group to be out rioting, and you get some alert about such and such in your neighborhood causing all kinds of havoc,
right,
maybe that's what you're looking for, and you're going to take up whatever defenses or offensive measures you think are necessary. That's a chaotic moment, and mm-hmm. that is kind of what makes it hard. Is like, okay, should you be questioning, a launch of some kind of missile, as we saw in Hawaii, like a couple, it wasn't a year ago.
Yeah, remember that?
That was a mistake by someone qualified to send these EAS messages.
That wasn't even something that was fake. It was just a mistake, and that can happen too.
How do you categorize, like, which EAS? Okay, like Amber Alerts, ignore all of those. Nobody cares. You know, I mean, do you really start having that kind of crass?
That's not Kyle saying that. He's quoting.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
I was being facetious.
Like. And sarcastic and all of that. But yeah, exactly. How do you categorize and then weight one emergency alert over another to ignore or pay attention to? And let me say, everyone listening to WBAI right now, pay attention to EAS alerts. We keep our EAS mechanisms nice and shiny, so you can trust alerts from this radio station.
But if you notice something doesn't make sense, say so, and have a conversation, and don't dismiss out of hand. Let me just ask you guys a question. If you had access, if you could just send a message over EAS, like this guy purports to be able to do, what would you say? What would you do? Alex, you have an idea? Gila, you have an idea. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, right now, if I were going to send a message over EAS right now. Just be stay home.
Okay.
Stay home.
So you're going to.
Outside is closed.
You're going to be responsible, and you're going to do what the system is designed for. Boring. Okay.
That's rude.
Alex, do you have something a bit more nefarious? That's what I'm looking for.
sure. I mean, I think it would be funny to send out something that says, hello world. The classic first line of, that you learn in every programming language. Mm-hmm. Or. support WBAI by calling 516-620-3602 and support community radio, something like that. Could you imagine?
Because hacking the emergency alert system is a surefire way to get support for WBAI. Yeah, I'm sure. Absolutely. I'm sure the feds would love us even more.
Yeah.
Rob, do you have an idea?
Yeah, I might go the responsible disclosure route. And my message would be, here's a hint to what you could fix, so I'm not able to do this.
That's good. That's both good and nefarious at the same time.
Like the IP that was... Wait, that could cause havoc. But yeah, the IP, the password, or just maybe the IP and, like, you know, change your password.
What I was thinking was just saying, don't believe anything you see. Because this is the fact that you're able to see what I'm writing instead of what is official should prove that you should always question. But it's getting a little wordy, I know. But at the same time, this is an invaluable service for those times when you do need to hear from somebody. But look at the security holes that you could drive a truck through. That's sort of the message. Did you have one, Kyle?
Oh, I can't think of anything. I just would say it's a good question. Mm-hmm. Maybe
it's like if you have access to Trump's Twitter account, which I don't think it should be a crime. If you had access to Trump's Twitter account and you tweeted something under his name, it's mischief. It's not a crime. The fact that you could start a nuclear war over Twitter, that's not your fault. That's our fault for believing everything you see on Twitter.
I'd probably put a quotation out there, like, or just say, like, don't panic.
I would say I quit. I'm on Trump's Twitter account right now. That's what I would do.
Wow.
Okay, we need to move on.
Go ahead,
Gila.
Sorry, I was just going to ask.
Yeah.
Trump's Twitter account probably won't be around much after the inauguration.
It'll be around. It'll be suspended. I'm pretty sure.
It'll be suspended.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure if he's going to get permanently banned because he's broken every single Twitter rule. And once he's not the president anymore, I think they're going to start enforcing, maybe.
Yeah, that's the hope.
I should not believe everything I see.
No. No, you should not. here's something.
I was hopeful though.
Okay, I'm sorry. This is my fault. I only have the second page of this story, so maybe you guys can help me figure out what the rest of the story is. These are apparently tips that we were sent. Look for I don't quite understand. Look for cameras before engaging in a fight. If you're already in a battle, shoot out any cameras you can see before your overheat bar fills up. Cameras can help enemies locate and easily hack you. Scanning the area for enemies is also a great preventative measure, as this can tell you which enemy can hack you. As soon as you see an enemy, you can quickly take them out before they hack you or do any significant damage. Identify enemy netrunners attempting to hack you. Once you find the hacker, you can shoot them out before your overheating bar fills. What am I talking about here?
That's crazy talk. Is that a letter?
I really wish I had the first page of that article. Hang on.
That must be a letter to OTH at...
No, it's not. It's a news story. This is a news story.
Oh, you're reading
Google News gave this to me.
That makes... That's really confusing. Wait, it's... What in the bar? What is the bar?
This must be this page here. Overheating in Cyberpunk 2077. What is that?
Oh, wow. Okay, this was the game title that had a bunch of errors.
This is a game?
I believe it is. Yeah. I heard, I think, a little bit about this.
So don't shoot at any cameras unless you're in a game. Is that okay? I'm sorry, folks. I thought I was giving out some valuable information for people that were going through hard times. But no. Okay, fine. Cyberpunk 2077. I have no interest whatsoever.
Yeah, I don't know much about it. I know they were having a lot of problems.
Cyberpunk 2020 is hard enough.
They're offering refunds, though, if you're not happy with it.
Are they?
Yes.
All right.
They want you to stick with them through their first round of updates. So,
Alex, I want to ask you. There's all this talk about some major systems being hacked. I'm seeing... talks of something called FireEye. I'm seeing talks of something called SolarWinds. It's very confusing. It has to do with all kinds of U.S. agencies, Russian hackers. What can you sum this up?
Yeah, this is a very, very interesting and I think a fast moving story, and it involves those pesky foreign actors again that we had just discussed a few moments ago. So in short, yeah, you're right. This is about FireEye and SolarWinds. They're two different companies. And so earlier this month, FireEye, which is a cybersecurity company that focuses on things like incident response, risk management, cyber threat intelligence, as well as penetration testing, found out it had suffered a breach. It had been hacked by somebody. Now, this was really big news. We talked about this a little bit last week with Welton Chang from Human Rights First, because FireEye is a company that engages in penetration testing and had unique toolkits used for probing and possibly compromising its customers' networks legally, right, as part of penetration testing. So if FireEye was compromised, then bad actors could use those toolkits for malicious reasons, and therefore, if they made their way out into the wild, you could be sure that other sophisticated threat actors, other foreign state actors or organized crime would use them precisely because it would give them a certain amount of cover, meaning it would be difficult to attribute the attack to any particular group or country. But here's where SolarWinds comes in, because the focus of the story has really changed over the last few days. Now, while FireEye was investigating its own breach, the breach of its own systems, and looking through apparently 50,000 lines of source codes and other source codes, it found that there was a backdoor within something called Orion SolarWinds. Now, Orion is the software, it's actually the platform. SolarWinds is a Texas-based company that makes the platform Orion. And what Orion does, in essence, is allow monitoring and management of complex and often geographically dispersed information technology assets, things that are critical to a business's operations. So you're going to have this Orion system on so that you can monitor it, make sure that systems and processes are not going out of whack, and you can restart certain things, reboot the machine, and make sure that it's operating effectively. So and in order to do that, you're going to have certain types of administrator access on that machine. Now, the threat actors behind this particular attack are supposedly some elite unit of Russian intelligence. And according to others, though, making that attribution may be a little bit premature, and I think that's probably correct. But what's critical to understanding how this whole thing happened is that the threat actors, whoever they are, and this is where it gets really interesting, appeared to have compromised SolarWinds' software build infrastructure. So once inside that infrastructure, once inside SolarWinds' place within their company where they build their software, where they do their coding, the bad guys then added malicious code, blending in their malware with legitimate code in really stealthy ways to prevent detection by things called YARA rules that are designed to find malware. And with that code going undetected, SolarWinds signed their new updates, meaning to all their customers, they appeared to be legitimate.
Oh,
they used a cryptographic form of signing this software. And when new updates were delivered to SolarWinds' client base, which is huge, the malicious code then allowed the threat actors access to the customer's networks through a backdoor. And according to the Hacker News Network, the malicious code actually may have been present as far back as October 2009. So we're going over a year.
2009 or 2019?
I'm sorry, 2019. Okay. Going over a year, yeah. 2009 would have been really precocious to do something like this. But it's not clear how the threat actors obtained access to the build infrastructure. This goes back to something Kyle had mentioned earlier. But Reuters had actually reported, I think it was today, that SolarWinds' update server was accessible with the password SolarWinds123, and that a security researcher had apprised SolarWinds of that information.
You see what I mean, Alex? We're not getting any more intelligent. We keep making the same damn mistakes. It's just we keep trusting more and more things. SolarWinds 123, huh? That was their password.
Yeah.
Bad
password. But that's not clear. To be fair to SolarWinds, I'm sure they have a very complex IT environment. There's probably lots of people. Maybe change management could have been more effectively managed.
SolarWinds 123, Alex. You can't get past
that. No. I'm sorry. How much billing did they do? And we're supposed to give them a break? This is classic, you had one job.
Pretty much.
However, there's no indication yet that SolarWinds 123 password was used as part of the breach of SolarWinds' build infrastructure and allowed them to get into it. It would have allowed people access to the update server, which, was part and parcel of how this all got distributed around the world to all of SolarWinds' customers.
Well, think about that. Think of the harm that was caused by that. SolarWinds basically infected their entire customer base. They did the work of these evil actors. And I'm putting that in quotes because, honestly, this is the kind of thing the U.S. government would do, and we'd call them the good guys, you know, for getting into some foreign country's infrastructure. I'm fascinated by this type of thing, and I think it's something that we need to learn from, and we have to expect it. It's not, you know, do you see this as an act of war or some kind of heavily punishable crime? I see it as a system being tested for what it's worth and finding out that it's not worth all that much.
Well, that's a good point, and I think it's an excellent question, too. And you look at the targets, the entities that we know to have been compromised by this particular incident involving SolarWinds' Orion platform, and there are a lot of governmental entities that relate to the federal government of the United States, like the Department of Commerce, Department of Homeland Security, Treasury. There's likely to be a whole bunch of others. In fact, there was a federal directive that came out instructing any agency or component of the federal government that was utilizing SolarWinds' Orion platform to disconnect it. And if this was Russian intelligence, or if it was any other intelligence operation, and they were targeting U.S. entities and governmental entities, well, then that, to me, sure, it would violate our criminal laws, but that's just bog standard practice when it comes to the collection of intelligence. That's what we do. That's mm-hmm. what every country does. If they use this to steal trade secrets, to steal intellectual property, to compromise the private networks of America's critical infrastructure that is involved in the private sector, then I think, you know, then we're crossing into a line that certainly involves criminality and theft and has gone beyond ordinary intelligence.
But because of the action, because of what they stole, I'm fascinated by doing it for the sake of just showing you can do it.
Certainly.
And quietly.
Yeah. And this was an absolutely amazing way to compromise so many people that are geographically dispersed, you know, as widely as their own IT assets are geographically dispersed, because you're piggybacking on something that already has what is essentially super user access to a whole bunch of these systems. You're just riding in, you know, with this, you know, this bus that's authorized to get into the compound. And that's what they did. And they got away with it for a long time. And a lot of people are hypothesizing that the reason why they got away with this for so long, when our intelligence community has this defending forward mentality where we're out there hunting for this type of activity, is because we were so focused on the security of the election infrastructure that we missed something like this. And that's quite possible. But, you know, look, the elegance of this type of attack, I think, is something, you know, to be commented on and to be, you know, commended, quite frankly. It is really, I think, a fantastically effective way of getting into the networks of a massive client base.
Yeah, you have to realize it's a game. And whoever this is, they won this game. They deserve respect for that. Whether crimes are committed after that, that's a different subject. But this to me, is a work of art. That's how you pull off a hack, and they seem to have done it really well. Guys, I don't want to cut this short, but I do want to mention that Overtime is starting at 8 o'clock on Channel 2600 on YouTube. And you can call us and be on that stream and archive as well. Phone number is 802-321-HACK. That's 802-321-4225. We will be opening up the stream 8 o'clock, Channel 2600 on YouTube. And we love to hear from you, and you can write to us too, oth@2600.com. But like to see people on the YouTube thing. It's an experiment we're trying. This way we can take phone calls, which we can't do right now since we're broadcasting from all over the place and don't have access to the board. If you dial 802-321-4225 at 8 o'clock and listen to Channel 2600 on YouTube, you can talk to us. And who knows? Who knows what else we might be able to do? Any closing comments, Alex?
No, I just, you know, wish everyone well who had their Christmases ruined by the SolarWinds platform hack, and good luck rebuilding your networks.
Yeah, don't take it too seriously. I mean, yeah, it sucks, but your job just changed a little bit. And we learned something, hopefully. SolarWinds 1, 2, 3. Come on, let's not do that anymore. Rob, Gila, any last words for you?
I just got to remember to change my password on all my stuff from SolarWinds 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Someone broke SolarWinds.
Oh, wow, that's a good one. Good one, Kyle. Okay. Please join us. Channel 2600 on YouTube. See you next week. Good night.
You're listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.